practices of Jewish life. For obviously these changes have long since been adopted or discarded. And there is reason to ask whether we have any other purpose for being, whether we have outlived our effectiveness, whether there's not perhaps a time for another approach to the problems of how to worship God within a Jewish frame. Now, one of the truths of religious history is that the religious rebels of one generation often become the defenders of tradition in the next, and that the reformers of one generation become the orthodox of the next. We see this in the history of the Christian Church, as it moves very rapidly from the apostolic poverty of the disciples to the magnificence of the Church of Rome. We see this in the history of Buddhism, as it moves from the asceticism of Gautama to the imperial church of Asoka. We see this in our own faith, as it moves from the simplicities of a portable shrine in the wilderness to the splendor and the elaborate priestly cult of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, it's very natural in the history of men to become preoccupied with institutionalism, with the reforms, the innovation, the thrust of the past. It seems almost inevitable that this be so. I remember the first year that I returned to Cleveland. I brought back with me a musical setting for one of the beautiful Rosh Hashanah psalms, Avinu Malkeinu, Our Father, Our King, We Have Sinned Before Thee. It had been written for me the year before in Chicago. We introduced it, and you liked it. We played it for a year, or two, or three. And then for one reason or another, the fourth year, it was dropped from the repertoire. And any number of people ran up to me after Rosh Hashanah night. They had nothing more important than to say, "And Rabbi, why do you keep introducing such new music?" And all we had done was to return the music which had been used 4 and 5 and 6 years before. Something that had been original 4 years ago had already become traditional. And we become enamored of it, dependent on it. Now the gerontologists, a new breed of physicians who deal with the problems of aging, tell us that the signs of age include these, that the body delays, slows down its ability to respond to external stimuli. We don't react as quickly. That we don't repair injury to the body as readily. It takes us longer to convalesce. That we require less food, and less drink, and less sleep to survive. Now, all human beings tend to age in relatively similar patterns. There may be a 10-year difference, a 20-year difference, but the days of our years are 3 score years and 10, and even by reason of strength, some 4 score years. And inevitably, strength becomes weakness. But when one looks at a religious institution, the parallel to the human system cannot be sustained. Because some religious bodies are born overnight and die overnight. Mithra, the worship of the sun god, was once the majority faith of the Roman Empire. And between its birth and its peak and its death, there were less than 3 centuries. And yet we have long live faith, the Roman Catholic, Rabbinic Judaism, Buddhism, which have lasted for centuries and millennia in relatively similar contexts. Relatively familiar form. If we want to draw an analogy between our own aging and the aging of religious structures, I think the only analogy we can draw is from what happens to us psychologically mentally. The gerontologists tell us that as we grow older, we lose our ability to see the particular difference, the newness of each succeeding day. We lose the ability to see the confusion, to deal with all the vagaries, the uncertainties, the inconclusiveness, the paradox of a particular moment. And we tend more and more to project past experience into the present. Our conversation tends to become more and more anecdotal, to be less conceptual, to deal with reminiscence, because we no longer lack the freshness of vision. We've seen so much and done so much that it's very hard now for us to see that today is different than yesterday and then the day before. I suppose this is what the prophet Joel meant when he wrote in the Bible years ago, Ziknechem chalamut yichalumun, bachurechem chazyonot yiru. Your old men shall dream dreams, while your young men shall see visions. Old men daydream. They project the past into the present. They live on the interest of joys, of vigor, of accomplishment once attained. The young men project the present into the future. They begin today. They plan for tomorrow. They're filled with hope and expectation. They're future-oriented. The Midrash put it this way, Kesheadam na'ar omer divrei zemer, hiskin omer divrei hezyonot. When a man is a young man, he sings while he works. He sings with excitement for the day. And when he grows old, he begins to gossip, to reminisce, and to deal largely in recollection, in words which are essentially vain because they don't lead directly to accomplishment. In other words, the older we get, the more we tend to objectify some moment in the past and to use it as a norm, as a measure, and to assume that the succession in days of days, the succession of people, the succession of events, the succession of responsibilities, more and more, more or less conforms to what we remember when our eyes were fresh and our ears were sensitive to the nuance, the subtleties of sound. Now, how do we know if a religious institution has grown old? I suppose one of the ways to discover it is to listen to the questions and the comments of the communicants. When they downgrade any suggestion of change by saying, but that's not the way we used to do it, you have an old institution. When they're unwilling to think of making changes, you have an old institution. Another way of judging an institution by its age is to see whether it is still talking of meaning, of purpose, of plans yet to be realized, or whether it's living in the past on its history. One of the few times I've really worried about the aging process of our own brand of Judaism came about 15 years ago, when those who are responsible for such things decided that they wanted to establish an Isaac Meir Wise Sabbath, a Sabbath to celebrate the man who was the institutional founder of many of our national denominational bodies, the seminary, the congregational union, and the like. Now, Isaac Meir Wise must have been a fairly nice fellow. He was a doughty, festy kind of person. He was a get-up-and-go organizer in the best American institutional tradition. But I reminded myself that in 3,500 years of history, we'd never had a Moses Sabbath devoted to the memory of Moses, but rather on every Sabbath we read Torat Moshe, the teachings of Moses. The Judaism survived because the basic teaching had depth, had bite, thrust, meaning, relevance. We had no need to celebrate Moses because we responded to his teachings. And believe me, if we ever bothered to read the teachings of Isaac Meir Wise, we'd find them superficial at the very best. Irrelevant, anachronistic, they've aged. When an institution begins to live on its past, to remember the glories of yesteryear and the great heroes of yesteryear, it's an old institution. And when an institution is talking to you of plans, of projects, of hopes, of vision, it has something that's still young, fresh about it. Now, there are in Jewish life, here and there, clusters of people who have aged. Some of them are dead, though they don't know it. They're fossilized Reformed Jews. You know the story of the Shlemiel who didn't know that he was alive until he would get up in the morning, get the daily paper, and turn to the obituary section and make sure that his name wasn't listed there. I sometimes look at these clusters of people in the same terms. And strangely, long after I had announced the subject for today, Friday of this week, I came across an article in the Jewish press which bespeaks these kinds of fossilized Reformed Jews. The article is dated St. Louis, and it reads this way. Temple Emmanuel here has decided to permit its sanctuary to be used for a private bar mitzvah service for the children of any member. Rabbi Blank took a full page in his bulletin to explain to the membership that while the board reaffirmed, quote, the principle not to enhance or promote or prepare youngsters for bar mitzvahs, the sanctuary could be used for such purposes, end of quote. On an adjoining page, the president related that the board took this step because after considerable discussion and after a male vote of the congregation, the vote was 149.5 for and 106.5 against. I kept wondering as I read this whether that family is together again, because obviously a husband and wife were on other sides of the issue. The rabbi said, quote, he was saddened that a number of individuals are unable to be reconciled with this change. He asserted that these were, quote, not on the fringe of the congregation, but members to whom the congregation is so important that they feel that something very important has been taken away from them. He pointed out that, quote, the practice of bar mitzvah gradually came back to Reformed Judaism. He added that, quote, many individuals felt that it was important for an individual child to have a rite of passage, the transition from one stage of life to another, to mark the coming into puberty. He said that, however, that the single most important factor was, quote, a general drift in American society, Jewish and non-Jewish, for rituals and ceremonies among the young who want concrete expressions of their faith. For those opposing the move, he said, this temple is not a museum piece. It was carved out almost 2 decades ago and then put on a pedestal to be admired and looked at from time to time, and year to year as a rare object, precious but not to be concerned with. Our congregation, he said, is a living entity. Well, if I read this correctly, that's the one thing that congregation is not. Because what is said here is not only that 106.5 individuals have decided that some form of, quote, Reform Judaism, ritually now, which was practiced 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 3 or 4 decades ago, is the only way in which Reform Judaism can be practiced. But 149.5 of those people said, yes, there ought to be changes, but we don't want to have really anything to do with it. We'll allow our sanctuary to be used as if we were rented out space, the same way a non-Jewish group could come in and have a service or a speaker. But we don't want to be sullied with such a terribly orthodox thing as a bar mitzvah. Now, what we have here is obviously a matter of ritual concern. And rituals are whatever people make of them. They're simply not that objectively important. But obviously, what we have here is a congregation which has in its mind, in its very bloodstream, an image of the past which it has projected on the present, a kind of frozen Judaism to which it insists everything must conform. Now, I don't know this congregation, and I don't know this rabbi. But if I'm not much mistaken, I would assume that I know certain things about them. And the most important thing that I know about them is that they look on themselves as liberal. The word reform allows you to think you're always on the far end of change. But that they assume that reform means some kind of denatured, dehydrated Jewish life, which will allow the Jew to be totally involved in the culture, in the social life, in the structure of mid-America. I'm sure these people are decent people. I'm sure these people are good parents. I'm sure these people would be the last to assume that they're orthodox or that their lives are guided by some kind of nostalgia. But I'm equally sure that they want their religious school to teach their youngsters some kind of basic decency without teaching them to be too Jewish. I'm equally sure that they want their rabbi to be involved in all kinds of civic activities, but they'd rather not he be a member of some Zionist organization. I'm sure that many in this congregation wonder why it is that Jews give their word disproportionately to the United Jewish Appeal as against the United Torch Appeal. I'm sure, in other words, that what we have here is a group of people who have not realized that not only has the nature of Jewish life changed, but the context, the envelope, the general culture in which we live has changed. And that people are bringing to Judaism, bringing to our congregations, a different set of questions and of needs. And that if reform has any meaning, it means the ability of Judaism to respond to the differing needs of different generations. To make my point, I'd like to suggest this model. That over the last 150 years, for those of us who broke decisively with the old medieval halakha, the concept that an all-embracing manifold law was given to us in all of its particularity, through Moses at Mount Sinai, that there have been two great waves of social change to which we've had to respond. This congregation, 106 and a half of them and 149 and a half of them, have responded only to the first of these great tidal waves of change. And I'd like to suggest to you what these two great dynamics to which we've had to respond are. The first tidal wave involved a basic political restructuring of Jewish life. The nation state, as we know it, arose in Europe about 400 years ago. Feudalism began to break down, and there was now a larger unit called a nation state. But membership, citizenship in that state was still governed by feudal structures called classes or estates, or castes of people. There was the nobility with one set of privileges, there was the clergy with another set of privileges, there were the city burgher class with a third set of privileges, there were the serfs generally without privileges. And then in the 18th century, men like John Locke and others began to talk of the concept of the citizenship of the individual, the old Greek concept of democracy, where it was not a caste or a class in which you were officially a corporate member, but you were, as an individual, a member of a community, of a nation. The American Constitution was the first large unit to establish the right of an individual within the social order. There were not to be estates in America, only citizens. The French Revolution was the first major revolution in Europe to talk of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Now, as long as the political structure governing Europe had been one where the basic unit of citizenship was the corporation, the class, Judaism was and remained a self-enclosed political world, a corporation. We were not part of the mainstream, we were set aside, we were ostracized and all of that. But we were self-governing according to the covenant of the halakha. Within our own world, we had a unified Jewish environment, a single Jewish law, a single principle of Jewish order. And this could last as long as everyone else was a corporate member of some group. But once corporate democracy broke down and we began to get individual citizenship, the Jew was faced with the difficulty that he was of a Jewish world, and yet he wanted so desperately to be part of the larger world. And in the 18th century, those who talked of the emancipation of the Jew, friends of the Jew, used this slogan again and again and again: to the Jew as Jew, nothing. To the Jew as Frenchman, or as Englishman, or as German, everything. There was a great big world out there. And suddenly there was talk of the possibility of the Jew being part of that world. Not a pariah, not someone who is set aside, but a full, equal member of his society. Some Jews rejected this, and they retained the sense of corporateness. Some Jews were so enamored of the possibility of being a member of the society that they threw over the Jewish world and tried to walk alone as a, quote, human being without any kind of religious affiliation into the larger world. And those who wanted to be happy schizophrenics, who for one reason or another were loyal to Judaism, loyal to their families, had a mystical sense of the value of the Jewish tradition, these tried to create a Judaism which could be lived within the new concept of democracy. And to do so, they essentially turned Judaism from a corporation into a congregation, from an all-embracing way of life to a Sabbath way of worship. They turned Judaism from a nationality into a religion, in the Western meaning of that term, a communion, a place where you go on the holy day for worship, while all else in your life is essentially secular, governed by the laws of the state. And this was done in order to preserve Judaism, not in order to destroy it. This was done because it was felt that we couldn't live encapsulated in a world which didn't want, which wanted people to be brothers, fraternal, colleagues, fellow citizens. And these changes took place at a time when the philosophy of man tended to be optimistic. It was believed that this really could happen, that cosmic systemic changes were taking place in the national political order, that a brave new world was dawning. And whether it was the promise of science, or the promise of democracy, or the promise of the Industrial Revolution, or the promise of dialectical materialism, whatever it was, men spoke throughout the 19th century and America till the end of the Second World War in basically optimistic terms. And so the Judaism which was reformed was both an attempt to create a religion which was not as demanding, as legally embracing as the old faith, and at the same time it was governed by a sense that there is something out there where we are welcome, that we can shed that which is particular and that which is special, that we have as Jews no particular agenda of Jewish politics, Jewish survival needs. That what we really need is to hasten the reform of the world, the democratization of human society, the triumph of the progressive powers in the world, and that when this happens, the Jew and the non-Jew, men of goodwill, will link arms and march together into a glorious future. That's stage one. It has less to do with what we normally think it has to do, changing the amenities of Jewish life, the aesthetics of Jewish life, some rituals of Jewish life, and much more to do with a basic change in the political structure by which we were organized. Now, the need to adjust Judaism to this new kind of democracy has not changed. But a basic emotional change, a basic philosophic change has come about in the last 100 years. And this is the beginning of the second great tidal wave to which we as Jews must necessarily respond. In 1848, when the great liberal revolution in Germany was successful, seemed to be successful, a rabbi got up at a rabbinic conference in Breslau, and he suggested to his colleagues that the phrase in the Haggadah, "Last year we were slaves, this year we are free," ought to be stricken from the book. "We're not slaves," he said, "here in Germany anymore, and we'll never be slaves again." And soon even our fellow Jews in Eastern Europe, in Tsarist Russia, will be able to throw off the shackles of slavery, come the revolution, and they too will be free, and they'll never revert again to slavery. And 3 years later, that rabbi was on a boat heading for these United States. The liberal revolution had failed. And this I take as typical of the failure of the liberal hope, which was so basic to the reform movement in phase one. Some Jews came to this recognition of the essentially tragic nature, the continuing tragic nature of the Jewish condition and of the human condition in the late 1840s and early 50s. Others came to it during the Dreyfus trial of the 1890s. Others came to it during the 1890s and 1900s with the Russian pogroms in Kishinev. Others came to it in 1910s and 1920s when they aligned themselves with the anarchists in Russia, with the socialists in Eastern Europe, and they found that here too there were great reservoirs of anti-Semitism. They were not welcome and they were not wanted. Some came to this new recognition on Kristallnacht. Some came to it when the British announced the White Paper of 1939, when the democracies of the West barred Israel to the refugees of Hitler. Some came to it with Auschwitz. Some came to it with the Stalin and the great purges. Some came to it during the last 25 years as Israel has struggled for peace and been denied peace. However, we have come to it. We have recognized that there continue to be some very particular, some very special responsibilities for Jewish survival. It's a fine Canadian Jewish theologian by the name of Emil Fackenheim, who insists that after, in our time, there's an 11th commandment, which reads, "Thou shalt not give to Hitler a posthumous victory," the commandment of Jewish survival. Whether there is or is not, there is no Jew who really does not recognize in 1973 that there are some very special, some very particular problems which we as Jews must take the leadership in solving because they affect Jews in the Soviet Union, in Israel, in Argentina, in South Africa, in these United States. And we've recognized this. We've recognized that there is no great body of men of goodwill out there eager to shed all the barriers, all the fears of the past, at a time when the very concept of democracy is being reshaped. The image of democracy which the early reformers had was that of the melting pot, where little by little all the differences would disappear and we would all become essentially one. We operate now with ethnicity, with black is beautiful. The sociological word is cultural pluralism, where there is the mass, and there are mass concerns, and there are special interest groups, and there are groups with all kinds of traditional particularity, specialness, we among them. But there is no bland, middle America out there that we can make ourselves over into. And the third element in this new tidal wave of change is our recognition that the messiahs of optimism, economic, political, social, the promises of science, the promises of technology, the promises of dialectical materialism, the promise of progressive reform in a democratic sense, that these promises, these philosophies have not been able to make good on their promise. We've had global war. We've had genocide. We've had Hiroshima and Auschwitz, the destructive symbols of this terrible destructive power of modern science. We live in a world which has lost faith in these simple, optimistic creeds. And more of us have felt that perhaps the old faith, which is not quite so optimistic, which insists that one obeys the ethical and religious law because it is God's will and trusts in God, and somehow good times, God's time, will come. So we've turned back to the old faith out of frustration, despair in the new. We've turned back to our tradition to give us encouragement in difficult times. We've turned to the God of Israel, the voice of that encouragement. And we've turned more and more to our own crusades and our own struggles, without denigrating the importance of our being involved in the needs and struggles of others, because if we don't fight our own fights, who will? And so we find ourselves now at a moment in time which is filled with change and paradox. We still have much of the hope of the early reformers. We are still liberal. We still believe that when there is a need for change, there must be change. But we recognize that we must not simply teach about God, we must find ways of expressing our faith in God. We must be, to use that terrible word, creative. At the same time, we want to have more color, more of the warmth of tradition. And we find ourselves in this congregation in that kind of paradoxical condition, which is a condition of modern life. We have services which are totally original, written by us, expressing us, and we have more Hebrew, more color, more ritual in the old service year by year. We need faith. We need hope. We need to change the forms and to change the things that we relate to. I think of as a symbol of this, of Confirmation Day, when the youngsters stand before us and join the adult congregation. For years and years around here, they sang an old 19th century kind of song, very square, very full of hope, and very un-Jewish, about the suppliant's children who stand before the throne of God, expressing the vow of Horeb, which is, I discovered about 10 years after I became a rabbi, the Shema. It is beautiful, but it is not essentially Jewish, not recognizably so. It speaks of moral responsibility, of the universal rather than of the particular. And what do they sing now? They sing the song that was sung in the concentration camps. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he's delayed, I shall await him. Now, they don't believe in the coming of a physical Messiah, but they need hope in their lives. And they're not in a concentration camp, they're in America. But at the same time, they're part of the Jewish people. And they're expressing the encouragement which comes from being a part of a long historic train which has survived whatever be the troubles and trammels of the day. What I'm suggesting to you is this, and if Reformed Judaism means anything, it means not a particular form of ritual or a particular book of worship or a particular ceremony. It means the willingness of Jews to find a vital, positive, meaningful Judaism by confronting honestly their tradition. If it means a more radical approach in some areas, so be it. If it means a more traditional approach in some areas, so be it. What it means above all else is honesty. What it means above else is a willingness to accept a new age, our new needs. The securities are gone. They went up in the ovens. They went up with the atomic bomb. They went up in the energy crisis. They're gone. We no longer believe, any of us really, that every day in some way the world is getting better and better. It's simply not. All of the futurists, those who predict what the world will be in the year 2000, say that there'll be less and not more. That man has been terribly profligate with God's bounty, and therefore we're all going to be impoverished to pay a price for the abuse of our environment, for overpopulation and the like. We live in a time when Jewish life has reverted to a degree to what it was always before the 19th century, and what human life, not only Jewish life, essentially is: paradoxical, tragic, uncertain. There are no guarantees. There are no certainties. There is only the voice of God, which is the voice of obligation, duty. Do. You shall not. No promises. If you only do your studies, get your A's on your report cards, there's going to be success in life. And no promises that if we live as good Jews and good human beings, the world is suddenly going to be filled with some kind of divine light, with peace and justice. But that's all we can do, isn't it? Do the good, to obey the voice of God, and to have faith as did our fathers, that God will in turn do his share, and we and he as partners will somehow establish the world in righteousness. I can't stand here and tell you what our practice here in the temple will be like 10 years from now. I don't know. Ritual is simply not that important. What is important is that we gain something from the meeting with God, with worship, that we leave inspired, encouraged, that we look on our tradition honestly, not as some words which we hear as if they're amulets and charms which somehow miraculously protect us, but that we listen to it. Perhaps in the ancient insight we'll find the meaning which somehow escapes us as we listen to the strident voices all around us. This congregation, any congregation, must do now what the synagogue has always been charged to do: to be a place of meeting, where we come from the loneliness of our individual lives and its dangers and find encouragement, where we tap again the sense of history and the encouragement which comes from it, we reach out again for God, for some understanding of duty, of right, of need, when we listen again to the old new words of Torah and find in them the meaning that is relevant and appropriate to our lives. We struggle, you and I, with the responsibilities of every day. We demand of our synagogues, do we not? They inform us, enlighten us, and encourage us, which is to say, the synagogue, the Reform synagogue, must be a place of ultimate seriousness. What we do must have meaning. We are not simply a society. We do not minimize the value of coming together in joyous moments. Here we confront God, meaning, ourselves, our future. And I know of no more important set of problems, no more urgent set of problems than these. Amen.